Random House Audiobooks presents Star Wars Rogue Planet by Greg Bear.
Rogue Planet. Anakin Skywalker stood in a long single-file line in an abandoned maintenance tunnel leading to the Wicco District garbage pit. With an impatient sigh, he hoisted his flimsy and tightly folded race wings by their leather harness and propped the broad rudder on the strap of his flight sandal. Then he leaned the wings against the wall of the tunnel and, tongue between his lips, applied the small glowing blade of a pocket welder to a crack in the left lateral brace. Repairs finished, he waggled the rotator experimentally. Smooth, though old. Just the week before, he had bought the wings from a former champion with a broken back. Anakin had worked his wonders in record time, so he could fly now in the very competition where the champion had ended his career. Anakin enjoyed the wrenching twist and bone-popping jerk of the race wings in flight. He savored the speed and the extreme difficulty, as some savor the beauty of the night sky, difficult enough to see on Coruscant with its eternal, planet-spanning city glow. He craved the competition, and even felt a thrill at the nervous stink of the contestants, scum and riffraff all. But above all, he loved winning. The garbage pit race was illegal, of course. The authorities on Coruscant tried to maintain the image of a staid and respectable metropolitan planet, capital of the Republic, center of law and civilization for tens of thousands of stellar systems. The truth was far otherwise, if one knew where to look, and Anakin instinctively knew where to look. He had, after all, been born and raised on Tatooine. Though he loved the Jedi training, stuffing himself into such tight philosophical garments was not easy. Anakin had suspected from the very beginning that on a world where a thousand species and races met to palaver, there would be places of great fun. The tunnel master in charge of the race was a Naplausian, little more than a tangle of string-like tissues with three legs and a knotted nubbin of glittering wet eyes.
"First flight is away," it hissed
as it walked in quick, graceful twirls down the narrow, smooth-walled tunnel. The Naplausian spoke basic, except when it was angry, and then it simply smelled bad.
"Wings up,"
it ordered. Anakin hefted his wings over his shoulders and cinched the harness he had cut down to fit the frame of a 12-year-old human boy. A voice spoke behind Anakin.
"You've raced here before."
Anakin had been aware of the blood carver in line behind him for some time. There were only a few hundred on all of Coruscant, and they had joined the Republic less than a century before. They were an impressive-looking people. Slender, graceful, with long three-jointed limbs, small heads mounted on a high, thick neck, and iridescent gold skin.
"Twice," Anakin said.
"And you?"
"Twice," the blood carver said amiably, then blinked and looked up. Across the blood carver's narrow face, his nose spread two fleshy flaps like a split shield, half hiding his wide, lipless mouth. The ornately tattooed nose flaps functioned both as a sensor of smell and a very sensitive ear, supplemented by two small pits behind his small, onyx-black eyes.
"You will probably die down there."
He spoke perfect basic, as if he had been brought up in the best schools on Coruscant.
"Thanks for the support," Anakin said, his face coloring. He hated being ragged, and he especially hated an opponent trying to psych him out. Fear, hatred, anger, the old trio Anakin fought every day of his life, though he revealed his deepest emotions to only one man, Obi-Wan Kenobi, his master in the Jedi Temple. The blood carver stooped slightly on his three-jointed legs. You smell like a slave, he said softly for Anakin's ears alone. It was all Anakin could do to keep from throwing off his wings and going for the blood carver's long throat. He swallowed his emotions down into a private, cold place and stored them with the other dark things left over from Tatooine. The blood carver was correct, which stiffened Anakin's anger and made it harder to control himself. Both he and his mother, Shmi, had been slaves to the supercilious junk dealer Watto. When the Jedi Master Qui-Gon Jinn had won him from Watto, they had had to leave Shmi behind, something Anakin thought about every day of his life.
You four next, the Tunnel Master hissed.
Mace Windu strode down a narrow side hall in the main dormitory of the Jedi Temple, lost in thought, and was nearly bowled over by a trim young Jedi who dashed from a doorway. Pardon me, Master, Obi-Wan Kenobi apologized, bowing quickly. Clumsy of me. In a hurry? A great hurry, Obi-Wan said. The Chosen One is not in his quarters. Mace's tone carried both respect and irony, a combination at which he was particularly adept. I know where he's gone, Master Windu. I found his tools, his workbench. Not just building droids we don't need. No, Master, Obi-Wan said. About the boy, Mace Windu began. Master, when there is time. Of course, Mace said. Find him, then we shall speak. And I want him there to listen. Of course, Master. Obi-Wan did not disguise his haste. Few could hide concern or intent from Mace Windu. Mace smiled. He will bring you wisdom, he called out as Obi-Wan ran down the hall toward the temple's sky transport exit. Obi-Wan was not in the least irritated by the jibe. He quite agreed. Wisdom or insanity. It was ridiculous for a Jedi to always be chasing after a troublesome Padawan, but Anakin was no ordinary Padawan. He had been bequeathed to Obi-Wan by Obi-Wan's own beloved master, Qui-Gon Jinn. Yoda had put the situation to Obi-Wan with some style a few months back as they squatted over a glowing charcoal fire and cooked shoe bread and whir in his small, low-ceilinged quarters. Yoda had been about to leave Coruscant on business that did not concern Obi-Wan. He had ended a long, contemplative silence by saying,
A very interesting problem you face, and so we all face, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Obi-Wan, ever the polite one, had tilted his head as if he were not acquainted with any particular problem.
The Chosen One Qui-Gon gave to us all, not proven, full of fear, and yours to save. And if you do not save him...
Yoda's words echoed in Obi-Wan's thoughts as he took an express taxi to the outskirts of the Senate District. Travel time? Mere minutes. Obi-Wan was concerned it would not be nearly fast enough. The pit spread before Anakin as he stepped out on the apron below the tunnel. The three other contestants jostled for a view. The blood carver was particularly rough with Anakin, who had hoped to save all his energy for the flight. What's eating him? The boy wondered. The pit was 2 kilometers wide and 3 deep from the top of the last accelerator shield to the dark bottom. This old maintenance tunnel overlooked the second accelerator shield. Squinting up, Anakin saw the bottom of the first shield, a huge concave roof cut through with an orderly pattern of hundreds of holes, like an overturned colander in Shmi's kitchen on Tatooine. Each hole in this colander, however, was 10 meters wide. There were over 5,000 such garbage pits on Coruscant. The city planet produced a trillion tons of garbage every hour. Here, waste was sealed into canisters, and the canisters were conveyed along magnetic rails to a huge circular gun carriage below the lowest shield. Every 5 seconds, a volley of canisters was repelled from the gun by chemical charges. The shields then guided the trajectory of the canisters through their holes, gave them an extra tractor field boost, and sent them into tightly controlled orbits around Coruscant. Hour after hour, garbage ships in orbit collected the canisters and transported them to outlying moons for storage. It was a precise and necessary operation, carried out like clockwork
day after day, year after year. Perhaps a century before, someone had thought of turning the pits into an illegal sports center, where aspiring young toughs from Coruscant's rougher neighborhoods could prove their mettle. The sport had become surprisingly popular on the pirate entertainment channels that fed into elite apartments. Enough credits were generated that some pit officials could be persuaded to turn a blind eye, so long as the contestants were the only ones at risk. A garbage canister hurled through the accelerator shields could easily swat a dozen racers aside without consequence. The last shield would supply it with the corrective boost necessary to compensate for a few small lives. Anakin's fellow racers took their places in the tunnel's exit, jockeying for the best position on the apron. The blood carver gave Anakin a jab with his jet-tipped right wing. Anakin pushed it aside and kept his focus. The Naplausian tunnel master made a thick, wickering noise, its way of cursing, and ordered the contestants to hold. A flying maintenance droid was making a sweep of this level. Managers could be bribed, but droids could not. They would have to wait until this one dropped to the level below. "Longer for you to live," the blood carver whispered to Anakin. "Little human boy who smells like a slave." Obi-Wan, against all his personal inclinations, had made it his duty to know the ins and outs of anything having to do with illegal racing anywhere within 100 kilometers of the Jedi Temple. Anakin Skywalker, his charge, his responsibility, was one of the best Padawans in the Temple, easily fulfilling the promise sensed by Qui-Gon Jinn. But as if to compensate for this promise, to bring a kind of balance to the boy's lopsided brace of abilities, Anakin had an equal brace of faults. His quest for speed and victory was easily the most aggravating and dangerous. Qui-Gon Jinn had perhaps encouraged this in the boy by allowing him to race for his own freedom 3 years before on Tatooine. But Qui-Gon could not justify Anakin's actions now. How Obi-Wan missed the unpredictable liveliness of his master. Obi-Wan, for all his talents, had been not just a little like Anakin as a boy, rough-edged and prone to anger, but he had soon come to find the quiet center of his place in the Force. In time, he had become the stable center, and Qui-Gon had become the unpredictable goad. How often it had struck him that this topsy-turvy relationship with Qui-Gon had once more been neatly reversed with Anakin. There were always two, Master and Padawan. And it was sometimes said in the temple that the best pairs were those who complemented each other. There were two garbage pits inside Anakin's radius of potential mischief, and one was infamous for its competition pit dives. It was never too difficult to sense Anakin's presence. Obi-Wan chose the nearest pit and climbed a set of maintenance stairs to the upper citizen observation walkway at the top. He ran along the balustrade. He was looking for the right turbo lift to take him to the lower levels, to the abandoned feed chambers and maintenance tunnels where the races would be staged. The next dive had been postponed until the observers were certain that the maintenance droid had passed to the next lower level. The tunnel master was very upset at the delay. The air was thick with its nauseating odor. Anakin drew on his Padawan discipline and tried to ignore the stench and keep his focus on the space between the shields. They could dive at any moment, and he had to know the air currents and sense the pattern of the canisters still flying through the accelerator ports in endless procession up and out into space. The blood carver was not helping. His irritation at the delay was apparently being channeled into ragging the human boy at his side, and Anakin was soon going to have to put up some sort of defense to show he was not just a stage prop. "I hate the smell of a slave," the blood carver said. "What makes you think I'm a slave?" Anakin asked as mildly as he could manage without appearing even more vulnerable. The blood carver's nose flaps drew together to make an impressive fleshy blade in front of his face. "You bought your wings from an injured lemur. I recognize them. Or someone bought them for you, a tout, I would guess, slipping you into the race to make someone else look good." "You, maybe?" Anakin said, and then regretted the flippancy. The blood carver swung a folded wing around, and Anakin ducked just in time. Even with the wings on his own back, he quickly assumed a defensive posture, as Obi-Wan had taught him, preparing for another move. The bad smell abruptly grew more intense. Anakin sensed the Naplausian right behind him.
A duel before a race? Maybe a holocam is needed here to amuse our loyal fans.
The Bloodcarver suddenly appeared entirely innocent, his nostril wings folded back, his expression one of faint surprise. The long, curved corridor circumnavigating the pit was filled with old machinery, rusting and filthy hulks stored centuries ago by long-dead pit maintenance crews. It was in this jumble that Obi-Wan found a thriving trade in race paraphernalia.
"Flight starting soon!"
cried a little lump of a boy, even younger than Anakin.
"Wages here for the greeter! 50-1 max, go home rich!"
"I'm looking for a young human racer," Obi-Wan said, bending down before the boy, sandy brown hair cut short, slender, older than you.
"Come to the greeter," the boy said. "He'll tell you what you want to know. Hurry, the race starts in seconds."
Obi-Wan was sure he could sense Anakin somewhere near, on this level. And he could also sense the boy was preparing for something strenuous, but whether for a fight or the competition, he could not tell. "Where can I buy a set of race wings?" Obi-Wan asked, fully aware there was little time for niceties.
"You a racer?"
The stout boy broke into howls of laughter.
"The greeter! He sells wings, too!"
Something was wrong. Anakin should have been aware of any anomalies earlier, but he had focused on preparing for the race, and what confronted him now was another matter entirely. The Naplausian Tunnelmaster had been alerted by an accomplice that the maintenance droid had dropped to the next level, and that had distracted the Tunnelmaster from Anakin. In that instant, the Bloodcarver withdrew one arm from a wing and reached into his tunic. That made no sense. Anakin suddenly realized the Bloodcarver's primary mission was not to race. "He knows I was a slave. He knows who I am. And that means he knows where I am from." The Bloodcarver swung out a twister knife.
"Padawan," he hissed,
and the spinning tips of the three blades glittered like a pretty gem. Anakin, hampered by the bulk of the wings, could not move fast enough to completely avoid the thrust. He bent sideways, and the knife missed his face, but one blade gouged his wrist. Quick as a snake, the Bloodcarver drew his arm back and aimed another thrust. Anakin had no choice. He kicked away from the tunnel, skidded down the sloping apron, and spread the race wings to their full width. Without hesitating, the Bloodcarver followed.
"Race not yet,"
the Tunnel Master husked, and his dense plume of stink left the other contestants gagging. Obi-Wan ran down a long tunnel, hoping he had located the one the racers were flying from, but found himself standing alone on the apron, staring across the vast lens-shaped space of the pit. He had only seconds to grasp the main points of this new piece of equipment he had purchased. He cinched the thorax straps of his wings as tight as the buckles would allow, then ratcheted the arm clamps until the struts threatened to bend. Whether the wings were charged and fueled, he did not know, until he swung up a little transparent optical cuff and attached it over his eye. The red and blue line showed a 1/4 charge in the small fuel tank, hardly enough for a controlled fall. Dying in a stupid garbage pit race, tangled in antique race wings, was not what Obi-Wan had hoped for as a Jedi. He looked to his left, saw a blank space of wall, then turned right, grabbing a broken metal bar to lean out. Obi-Wan saw Anakin standing on the apron of the tunnel to his immediate right, about 50 meters away. He was just in time to witness the confused tangle of limbs and the flash of a weapon. Obi-Wan leapt just as Anakin fell or jumped, and barely had time to observe a Bloodcarver, Anakin's assailant, leap after. His wings spread wide with almost no effort, and the tiny motors at their tips coughed and whined to life. Sensors on the strut searched for the intense tractor fields that permeated the space between the huge curved shields. By themselves, the wings could not have supported a boy, much less a man, but by using the stray fields from the accelerator ports, a flyer could perform all sorts of aerobatics. The first maneuver that Obi-Wan mastered, however, was to fall straight down. Almost 300 meters. Anakin's confusion and pain quickly reformed into a clarity he had not experienced in many years. 3 years, to be precise, since his last pod race on Tatooine, when he had last been so close to death. It took him almost 3 seconds to roll to a proper position, feet angled slightly down, wings folded by his side, head tilted back against the brace, like diving into an immense pool. Then slowly, the wings seemed to spread without his conscious volition. The motors coughed and sputtered to a sharp, well-tuned whine. He had fallen less than 100 meters. The wings, spread to their full width of 5 arm spans, quivered and shuddered like living things as they caught the air and the fields. As the motors responded to subtle jerks of his arms, he gained complete control and soared. Not bad, he thought, for someone so close to dying. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw what he thought might be the blood carver twirling like a falling leaf below and to his left. He saw the figure scrape the wall of the pit and tumble, catch a gust, and go right again. But this hapless flyer was not the blood carver. His assailant had leapt from the apron after him and was now soaring on a parallel about 20 meters to his right. No doubt their status as contestants had been canceled by the tunnel master. Very well, Anakin thought. He never cared much for the formalities of victory. If this was a contest solely between him and the murderous blood carver, so be it. The prize would be survival. No worse than pod racing against a Dug. Obi-Wan looked right and saw Anakin assume his flight position. Obi-Wan spread the wings and let his feet drop below the level of his head. He knew enough about lift-wing racing to catch the vibrations in his palms, to understand what they implied, to grab the strongest gradient field available to him, and to soar out across the shield. Then the buzz in his palms became frantic. He saw a 10-meter-wide hole, passed over it, felt the tractor field strengthen near the next port, and swerved to one side just in time to avoid the ear-stunning bellow of a garbage canister. The updraft and roil of air in the canister's wake pulled him up like a fly caught in a dust devil. Deafened by the noise, wings shuddering uncontrollably, his palms hot with the frantic buzz of the sensors, he wrapped the wings tightly to his sides to break loose from the strongest part of the field. Across the pit, another canister roared through a port in the lower shield and was shunted by the tractor fields to its next port. And another. A volley was underway. Obi-Wan had no idea where Anakin was or whether he was still alive. And until he gained more than just rudimentary control of the wings, his Padawan circumstance mattered little. The goal of the garbage pit race was to fly across the convex surface of the lower shield, drop through a port not currently fully charged with an acceleration field or filled with a rising canister, and then do it all again for the next 2 shields below that, until one arrived at the bottom of the pit. Once at the bottom, all the contestant had to do was grab a scale from a garbage worm while still airborne, and then ascend through the shields and present the scale to the judge, that is, to the greeter, who controlled nearly all the action in these affairs. Garbage worms were huge, unfriendly, and essential to the efficient operation of the pit. Garbage not packaged for export into space was mixed into a slurry of silicone oils and processed by the worms. Arrayed in the slurry like jumbled nests of thick cable, the slowly writhing worms reduced the garbage to carbon dioxide, methane, and other organics that floated in thick islands of pale yellow froth on the roiled surface of the silicone lake. The worms had scales that were large and loose, glittered like diamonds, and were prized by the greeter, who sold them to a small but select market of collectors as sports memorabilia. Anakin performed a roll and looked up. The blood carver was on his left now. The other contestants had leapt after them, so the race was on after all. The tunnel master must have decided the disruption only added to the sport. Anakin could think of no better plan than to win the race by staying far from the reach of the blood carver and presenting a worm scale to the greeter. Then he'd return to the temple before anyone noticed he was missing. He could be back in training with Obi-Wan inside of an hour, and he would sleep well tonight with no bad dreams. Obi-Wan picked himself up from the broad, curved surface of the shield and quickly, with Jedi expertise, assessed his physical condition. He was bruised, frustrated. He quickly damped that, for frustration could easily lead to self-defeating anger. But he had avoided breaking any bones.
He was also winded, but recovered even as he looked around to locate the other racers. Anakin circled in a slowly ascending spiral over the center of the shield and about 100 meters above it. Obi-Wan prepared his wings for another liftoff, just as he saw his Padawan tuck like a diver and drop out of sight through the shield's central hole. Anakin felt a pure kind of joy as he spread his wings and caught a field in the next lower level. The blue ion trails, the lightning that played continuously between plumes of discharge smoke, and the drumbeat roar of ascending canisters were beautiful. But more important, they all, with one almost living voice, called out a challenge greater than anything he had experienced on Tatooine, including the Bunta Eve pod race. This was a place most would find terrifying, where most beings would certainly die. Yet he would gladly live out the rest of his life in this kind of immediate peril, if he could simply forget the past failures that haunted him at night whenever he tried to sleep. The failures, and the terrifying sense of carrying something beyond his power to control. Again, he picked out his port near the shield center where few canisters were launched. He could feel the pulse of the huge gun carriage beneath this lower shield. Anakin listened for the hesitation, the brief silence followed by a bass grind and chuff before a ring of canisters was chambered and fired. Best, of course, to drop through a port during a lull between discharges and away from a port where a canister had recently passed, with its flux of gases, updrafts, lightning, and ion trails. Running on pure instinct, a mote of dust in the game, Anakin tucked his wings once more and dropped through the central port in the shield. He did not notice, 50 meters above him, that the blood carver did the same. The air above the rotating gun carriage was almost unbreathable. Fumes from the exploding charges, simple chemical explosives, could not be vented and processed fast enough to prevent a toxic pall from forming below the first shield. Added to this perpetual burnt rubber haze were the miasmic vapors from the silicone-filled basin below the gun carriage. It was here that the most primitive, not to mention the largest, creatures on Coruscant lived and performed their functions in a perpetual twilight, illuminated only by the fitful glows of work lights hung from the undersides of the gun carriage supports. The largest worms were hundreds of meters long and 3 or 4 meters wide. Anakin glided to one side of the lowest level and alighted on a carriage support. He had conserved most of his fuel for this moment. Once he had plucked loose a glassy worm scale, he would have to jet upward and catch a canister updraft, then be pulled through a port to the void above the first shield. This was insanely difficult. All the better. Anakin wrapped a breather mask over his mouth and nose. He attached his optical cup and pulled down bubble goggles to protect his eyes from the silicone spray. Then he tensed to leap. But he had made a Jedi apprentice's first mistake, to direct all one's attention on a single goal or object. Focus was one thing, narrow perception another, and Anakin had ignored everything above him. He felt a prickle in his senses and looked to one side just in time to catch, with the top of his head, a blow aimed at his temple. The blood carver glided past and landed on the next stanchion, watching with satisfaction as the young Jedi tumbled headlong toward the churning worm mass. Then the blood carver followed, long neck stretched forward, nostril flaps clapped together in a wedge, gliding down to finish his day's work. Anakin's fall was cushioned by an island of the thick, smelly froth that floated across the Lake of Worms. He sank slowly into the froth, releasing more noxious gases, until a burst of ammonia jerked him to stunned consciousness. His eyes stung. The blow to his head had knocked his goggles and breather mask awry. First things first. He spread his wings and unbuckled his harness, then rolled over to distribute his weight evenly along the wings. They acted like snowshoes on the froth, and his rate of sinking slowed. The wings were bent and useless now anyway, even if he could tug them from the foaming mass. The blood carver had just murdered him. That death would take its own sweet time to arrive was no relief from its certainty.
Reaching out to put himself in tune with a force might be soothing, but he'd not yet reached the point in his training of being able to levitate, at least not more than a few centimeters. Anakin's brain was in full gear now, his thinking clarified by the ache in his skull. The blood carver knew who he was, where he was from. Someone was either stalking Anakin personally, or Jedi in general. Anakin doubted he had attracted much attention during his short life, or was worthy of an assassin's interest by himself. Far more likely that the temple was being watched, and that some group or other was hoping to take down the Jedi one by one, picking the weakest and most exposed first. That would be me, he thought to himself. The Blood Carver was a threat to the people who had freed Anakin from slavery, who had taken him in and given him a new life away from Tatooine. If he was never to be a Jedi or even live to maturity, he could remove at least one threat against that brave and necessary order. He pulled up his breather mask, took a lungful of filtered air, and examined his foundering platform. A wing brace could be broken free and swung about as a weapon. He stooped carefully, balancing his weight, and grasped the slender brace. The rotator ball made a fair club. The blood carver swooped low, his legs drawn back, triple-jointed arms hanging like the pedipalps on a claw swift on Naboo. He was focused completely on the Padawan, making the same mistake as Anakin. With a heart leap of hope and joy, Anakin saw Obi-Wan winging over the blood carver. The master extended the beam on his lightsaber as he dropped with both feet on the assailant's wings and snapped them like straws. Two swipes of the humming beam, and the outer tips of the blood carver's wings fell away. The blood carver gave a muffled cry and flipped on his back. The fuel in his wingtip tanks caught fire and spun him in a brilliant pinwheel, elevating him almost 20 meters before sputtering out. He fell without a sound and slipped into the lake a dozen meters away, raising a small, gleaming plume of oily silicone. Ghosts of burning methane swirled briefly above him. Obi-Wan recovered and raised his wings just in time to end up buried to his waist in the froth. The look on his face as he collapsed the lightsaber was pure Obi-Wan. Patience and faint exasperation, as if Anakin had just failed a simple spelling test. Anakin reached out to help his master stay upright. "Keep your wings up! Keep them high!" he shouted. "Why?" Obi-Wan said. "I cannot vault the two of us out of this mess." "We can combine our fuel," Anakin said, his eyes bright in the murk. The froth rippled alarmingly. At the edge of their insubstantial island of foam, a gleaming silver-gray tube as wide as four arm spans arched above the silicone slurry. Its skin was crusted with stuck-on bits of garbage, and its side was studded with a lateral line of small black eyes edged in brilliant blue. The eyes poked out on small stalks and examined them curiously. The worms seemed to be considering whether they were worth any effort to eat. Even now, Anakin observed the prized scales glittering along the worm's length. "The best I've ever seen, big as my hand." Anakin reached down with all the delicacy and balance he could muster and unhooked the fuel cylinders from his wings. Obi-Wan concentrated on keeping himself from sinking any deeper into the sticky foam. Another arch of worm segment, high and wide as a pedestrian walkway, thrust itself toward them. More eyes looked them over. The arch quivered as if with anticipation. "I'll never be this stupid again," Anakin said breathlessly as he attached the tanks to Obi-Wan's wings. "Tell it to the Council," Obi-Wan said. "I have no doubt that's where we'll both be if we manage to accomplish six impossible things in the next 2 minutes." More coils surrounded them, other, bigger worms. Obviously, the Jedi, master and apprentice, looked tasty, and now a competition was underway. The segments whipped back and forth, striking the edges of the island. The froth broke away, flying up in disintegrating puffs, until there was hardly more remaining than an unwieldy plug. Anakin gripped Obi-Wan's shoulder with one hand. "Obi-Wan, you are the greatest of all the Jedi," he told him earnestly. Obi-Wan glared at his Padawan. "Could he give us just a little boost?" Anakin pleaded. "You know, up and out?" Obi-Wan did, using all the concentration he could muster under the circumstances, and Anakin lit off their jets at the very same instant. The jolt did not distract him from reaching out with outstretched fingers, grazing a curve of worm skin, and grabbing a scale.
Somehow they lifted to the first shield and slipped into the updraft of a discharged canister. Spinning, knocked almost senseless, they were drawn up through a port. Obi-Wan felt Anakin's small arms around his waist. "If that's how it's done," the boy said, and then something, was it his Padawan's newfound skill at levitation, lifted them through the next shield as if they lay in the palm of a giant hand. Obi-Wan Kenobi had never felt so close to such a powerful connection with the Force, not in Qui-Gon, nor Mace Windu, not even in Yoda. "I think we're gonna make it," Anakin said. "The opportunities are endless," Wraith Synar said as he walked along the factory parapet. Beside him strolled Commander Tarkin of the Republic Outland Region's Security Force. They might have been brothers. Both were in their early 30s. Both were thin and wiry, with high-arching, bony brows, piercing green eyes, aristocratic faces, and attitudes to match. And both wore robes of senatorial favor, showing extraordinary service to the Senate over the past decade. "You're speaking about the Republic?" Tarkin asked, with more than a hint of disdain. His training, he came from an old and well-established military family, gave his voice a particular edge, both world-weary and amused. "Not at all," Synar said, smiling at his old friend. "Beyond and below the parapet, 4 advanced project ships approached completion. They were black, sleek, smaller than previous models, and very fast indeed." "I haven't received an interesting contract from the Republic for 7 years. "What about these?" Tarkin asked. "Private contracts with the Trade Federation, several mining firms, others. Very lucrative, so long as I don't sell my very best weapons to the wrong buyers. Every ship I make, I equip with weapons, as you doubtless know, so I keep the best in reserve for my most generous customers." Tarkin smiled at this answer. "Then I may have useful news for you," he said. "I've just come from a secret meeting. Chancellor Palpatine has finally forced a stand-down over the Naboo incident. The Trade Federation security forces will soon be disbanded. In the next few months, they are to be assimilated into Republic forces and placed at the disposal of the Senate. All will comply, even outland mining, or face a centralized and much more powerful military response. If they are your main source of income, your position now is, shall we say, compromised." Synar tipped his head to one side. He had already caught wind of Chancellor Palpatine's decree. "I will miss Trade Federation patronage, but I don't see a complete collapse of their influence for some time." They advanced to the end of the parapet and along a suspended walkway leading to an octagonal, transparisteel-walled room suspended 30 meters above the center of the factory floor. "Now, enough about my business worries. About our relationship." Tarkin rested his hands on the rail. "I've made new contacts," he said. "Extremely useful contacts. I can tell you very little more." "You know I'm an ambitious man," Synar said, with a look he hoped seemed both hungry and dignified. Tarkin would not be easy to fool. "I have plans, Tarkin, which will impress anyone with imagination." "I know plenty of people with imagination," Tarkin said. "Perhaps too much imagination at times." They continued walking. "And in truth, I've come to pick your brain, tell you a remarkable fairy tale, and enlist you in my cause, old friend. But not out here. Not out in the open." Inside the transparisteel-walled design room, closed to all but Synar and his special guests, Tarkin sat in a comfortable chair of inflatable plastic, one of Synar's design. Next to him, a large, dark gray holographic table hummed faintly. Synar dropped black security curtains all around the lighted center. The men were absorbed in an eerie silence. "I do small favors for certain people," Tarkin said. "Some of these people have an appreciation for fingers, not tentacles, my friend, not palps, but human fingers, reaching into a great many stellar soup bowls, testing the temperature to see if they are ready for the eating." "Why the concern that they be human?"
Humans are the future, Wraith. Some of my best designers are not even remotely human.
Yes, and we employ non-humans wherever they are useful, for now. But mark my words, Wraith, humans are the future.
Wraith noted the tension in Tarkin's voice. So marked.
Now listen closely. I'm going to tell you a tale of intrigue, wonderfully ornate, yet at its heart, very simple. It involves a kind of spacecraft, rare and seldom seen, very expensive, of unknown manufacture, supposedly a toy for the wealthy. It may ultimately lead to a lost planet covered with a peculiar kind of forest, very mysterious, and it may soon involve the Jedi.
Sinar smiled in delight. I adore stories about the Jedi. I'm quite the fan, you know.
I myself am intrigued by them, Tarkin said with a smile. One of my assignments, I will not tell you who does the assigning and how much they pay, is to keep track of all the Jedi on Coruscant, keep track of them, and discourage any increase in their power.
Sinar lifted an eyebrow. The Jedi support the Senate, Tarkin. Tarkin dismissed this with a wave of his hand.
There is a youngster among the Jedi with a curiosity for droids and all sorts of machinery, a kind of junk collector, though with some talent, I understand. I have placed a small, very expensive, very broken droid in the way of this youngster, and he has taken it into the Jedi temple and made it mobile again, as I suspected he would. And it has been listening in to some very curious private conferences.
Sinar listened with growing interest, but also growing puzzlement. As far as Sinar was concerned, for all their gallantry and discipline, the Jedi were technological ignoramuses, but for their lightsabers, of course. Yes, those were of interest.
Please pay attention, Wraith.
Tarkin jerked him out of his reverie.
I'm getting to the good part.
Half an hour later, Sinar was pale and his hands shook slightly. Tarkin's moving in on what could have been mine. But he quelled his chagrin. The secret was out. The rules had changed. Absently, and to create a distraction from his reaction to Tarkin's story, he switched on the hologram display, and millions of tiny curves and lines assembled in the air over the dark gray table. They formed a slowly rotating sphere, with a wide slice removed from the side. With a contentedly prim expression, Tarkin turned to the hologram. He bent over to examine the scale bars, and his eyebrow lifted.
Impossibly huge, he commented dryly. A schoolboy fancy?
Not at all, Sinar said, taking note of Tarkin's interest. Quite doable, though expensive.
You've piqued my curiosity, Tarkin said. What is it?
One of my show projects, to impress those few contractors with a taste for the grandiose, Sinar said. But Tarkin, why have these people chosen me?
You haven't forgotten you're human.
That couldn't be their main criteria.
You'll be surprised, Wraith. But no, likely at this stage, it is not crucial. It's your position and your intelligence. It's your engineering expertise, far greater than my own. Though, dear friend, I do excel beyond you in military skills. And, of course, I do have some influence. Stick with me and you'll go places. Fascinating places.
Tarkin could not take his eyes off the slowly rotating sphere with its massive core-powered turbolaser now revealed.
Ah, he smiled. Always a weapon or two. Have you shown this to anybody?
Sinar shook his head sadly. He could see the enticement was working. The Trade Federation knows precisely what it needs and shows no interest in anything else, a deplorable lack of imagination.
Explain it to me.
It's a dream, but an achievable dream given certain advances in hypermatter technology. An implosion core with a plasma about a kilometer in diameter could power an artificial construct the size of a small moon. A couple of large ice asteroids for fuel, common enough still in the outer fringe systems.
A small crew could police an entire system with one vessel, Tarkin mused.
He smiled proudly.
I knew I picked the right man for this job, Wraith.
I'm not sure I have any free time, Sinar said with a frown. Despite my lack of connections, I still managed to keep very busy.
Tarkin waved his hand dismissively. Forget those shadows of a past life and focus on the future. What a future it will be, Wraith, if you satisfy the right people.
Within the inner temple, the domain of the Jedi Knights and their Padawans, the chambers were kept cool with lighting at a minimum. The overall effect, to an outsider, might have been one of studious gloom. But to a Jedi, the inner temple was a center of learning, chivalry, and tradition unparalleled in the known universe. It was meant to be a place of peace and reflection, commingled with periods of rigorous training. Increasingly, however, the Jedi Council devoted its time to troublesome matters of politics and the large-scale repercussions of a decades-long economic collapse. That explained why so many of the Masters were away from the temple, scattered around the crumbling fringes of the Republic. It did not explain why Mace Windu maintained a bemused smile even as he presided over the distressing case of Anakin Skywalker. The Padawan looked more than a little bewildered. Obi-Wan stood beside him, as a master must when his apprentice is in peril of dismissal. Four Masters were present, the other chairs were empty. Obi-Wan remembered several disciplinary hearings for his own master, Qui-Gon Jinn, yet none had been held in such a charged atmosphere as this, no matter Mace Windu's amused expression. Anakin Skywalker has been with us 3 years now and has shown himself a capable student, Mace began. More than capable, brilliant, with abilities and strengths we have all hoped to see developed and controlled. Mace rose and walked around the pair, his robes swishing faintly. Strength of character is a challenge to be overcome by a Padawan, for it may be a mask for careless will, lacking center and purpose. A Jedi is allowed no such weakness. He stopped in front of the boy. Anakin Skywalker, explain to the Council how you can find peace by seeking cheap thrills among the most deluded occupants of this planet. What is your error? Obi-Wan stepped forward to speak, but Mace's hand shot up, and his eyes sparked with warning. Though a master must defend his Padawan, it was clear the Council was beyond that here. Obi-Wan suspected the worst, that a judgment had already been rendered and that Anakin was to be released from the temple. Anakin watched Mace with large eyes, uncharacteristically subdued. "I seek to escape pain," Anakin said. "My mother..." Mace lifted his hand and Anakin instantly fell silent. "Pain can be our greatest teacher," Mace said, barely above a whisper. "Why turn away from pain?"
It is my strength. This I see."
"That is not correct," Obi-Wan said, placing his hand on Anakin's shoulder. The boy looked between them, confused. "How is it wrong, teacher?" Mace asked Obi-Wan.
"Lean upon pain like a crutch, and you create anger and a dark fear of truth," Obi-Wan said. "Pain guides, but it does not support."
Anakin cocked his head to one side. He seemed slight and even insubstantial among these Jedi Knights, all this overwhelming experience. His face collapsed in misery.
"My most useful talents are not those of a Jedi."
"Indeed, you throw your spirit and your anguish into machines and useless competitions, rather than directly confronting your feelings," Mace said. "But we are away from the crux of our present matter. Try to explain your error." Anakin shook his head, caught between stubbornness and tears.
"I don't know what you want me to say."
Mace took a shallow breath and closed his eyes. "Look inward, Anakin."
"I don't want to," Anakin said breathlessly, his voice jerking. "I don't like what I see."
"Is it possible you see nothing more than the tensions of approaching adulthood?" Mace asked.
"No," Anakin cried. "I see too much, too much."
"Too much what?"
"I burn like a sun inside."
The boy's voice rang out in the chamber like a bell. "Remarkable," Mace Windu admitted. Curiously, a smile flickered on his lips. "And?"
"And I don't know what to do with it. I want to run. It makes me reckless. So I seek sensation. I don't blame any of you for..."
He could not finish that sentence. The door in the far wall swung open slowly. Mace and Obi-Wan looked up to see who was there.
A small female figure clad in temple robes stepped into the circle, and a clear voice sang through the chamber.
Just as I thought, a little inquisition going on here, eh?
Mace got to his feet, smiling broadly at the sarcasm. Welcome, Thracia. Obi-Wan bowed his head in respect.
Anakin, may I stand beside you?
Thracia Cholim walked slowly toward the center of the chamber where Obi-Wan and Anakin stood. Her gray hair was cut to a close cap on her long skull, and her aquiline nose sniffed at the cool air as if she judged all by their scent. She gathered her long dark robes and pulled up her sleeves to reveal strong, thin arms. Then she thrust out her chin.
I should have warned you I'd return, Mace, she said.
It is always an honor, Thracia, Mace said.
You seem to be ganging up on this boy.
It could be worse, Mace said. Most of the council are away today. Yoda would be much harsher.
That big-eared tree stump knows nothing about human children, and for that matter, neither do you.
You've never married, Mace. I have. I have many sons and daughters on many worlds. Sometimes I think you should all take a break, as I did, and sniff the real air, see how the Force manifests in everyday life, rather than mope around learning how to swing lightsabers.
Mace's smile became one of delight. It is wonderful to have you with us, Thracia, after so many years.
There was not a hint of irony in his tone. He was, in fact, pleased to have her in the room, and seemed even more pleased that she had surprised them.
What do you suggest for young Skywalker?
Thracia was about Anakin's height and looked him straight in the eyes.
I ask you, boy, what do you want to prove?
You came back this afternoon covered with slime and smelling of garbage. It's the talk of the staff in the temple.
I don't want to prove anything. I need to know who I am, as Obi-Wan tells me over and over.
Thracia sniffed and regarded Obi-Wan with a mix of affection and sharp judgment.
Obi-Wan has forgotten ever being a child, as far as I can judge.
Obi-Wan gave her a small grin. Qui-Gon would have disagreed.
Qui-Gon! Now there was a child, all his life a child, and wiser than most. But enough banter. I sense there is real danger here.
There was an assassination attempt, Obi-Wan said, a blood carver.
We suspect involvement from dissident forces within the Republic, Mace said. He knew all about me, Anakin added.
All? Thracia inquired, arching a brow at Mace.
I led him.
The boy's eyes widened in realization. He stared at Obi-Wan.
Master, I realize my error.
Obi-Wan folded his arms. He and Anakin might have been brothers separated by only a double handful of years, but Obi-Wan was the closest thing the boy could ever have to a father.
Yes.
I sought out personal peace and satisfaction in the pit race rather than thinking of the greater goals of the Jedi.
And, Obi-Wan encouraged,
I pursued personal goals, even after it should have been obvious to me that the temple was being threatened.
Very serious indeed, Thracia murmured. She took Anakin by the shoulders, then glanced at Obi-Wan to see